Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from New York State United Teachers, a union of professionals standing with more than 600,000 workers in education, human services, and healthcare with the Our Voice, Our Values, Our Union campaign. And United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President. UUPinfo.org.
A new law that decriminalizes possession of up to 2 ounces of marijuana took effect last week. Governor Andrew Cuomo says it's long overdue, but some advocates say the law doesn't go far enough. The Legislative Gazette's Karen DeWitt has more.
Possession of up to 1 ounce of marijuana is punishable by a $50 fine. Anyone caught with 2 ounces of cannabis would be fined up to $200. The measure also creates a mechanism to expunge the records for some past marijuana convictions. Governor Cuomo says in a statement that it will help communities of color that have been disproportionately impacted by the state's marijuana laws over the past several decades. Melissa Moore with the Drug Policy Alliance says expunging past criminal records for marijuana possession is a significant step forward.
To provide a measure of relief for hundreds of thousands of New Yorkers that were unjustly caught up in the criminal legal system because of biased and targeted enforcement of prohibitions.
The state's Department of Criminal Justice Services, or DCJS, will spend the next several months setting up the expungement program. But Moore says the further decriminalization of cannabis falls short and may not result in fewer arrests and punishments for African American, Latinx, and low-income New Yorkers who have been disproportionately targeted by law enforcement. She says New York City in 2014 adopted a policy to stop arresting people for low-level marijuana possession. But she says according to recent data from DCJS, the number of arrests were indeed down, but people of color were still disproportionately arrested more frequently.
In more well-to-do areas, we saw a continued drop in arrests. And in other parts of the city, what we ended up with, when we look at the data for at least the beginning part of 2018, which is available so far in the beginning part of this year, what we see is that nearly every single person who was arrested in New York City for low-level marijuana was a person of color. And we know that people use at roughly similar rates across different racial and ethnic groups. And so that extreme disparity is one that continues to be absolutely unacceptable.
Under the new law, a person can still be arrested for possession of the drug, even if it ultimately results in just a fine. People possessing 2 ounces or less of cannabis can also have their children removed from their home, and if they are undocumented immigrants, could face deportation. The Drug Policy Alliance and other groups believe that the only way to change that is to legalize recreational use of the drug and closely regulate it.
And actually have much better say over who has access, what that looks like, making sure that we have consumer protections in place.
A legalization bill did not gain enough votes in the state Senate to pass before the legislative session ended in June. Advocates say they will press for the measure in 2020. In Albany, I'm Karen DeWitt.
Joining us now, Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Chartok. Alan, let's start this week with a group of inmates suing the state's prison system, saying its efforts to crack down on prescription drug abuse have gone too far. 18 prisoners say in a suit filed this week that they're being forced to live with chronic pain because it has become too hard to get approval for some medications. The Department of Corrections and Community Supervision says the agency is, quote, committed to battling the opioid epidemic and stemming the tide of addiction.
Hey, David, that's the other side of this whole thing. These drugs were created to help. We have a very good friend who was in the hospital recently and who, you know, is suffering great cancer and was given drugs, thank God, to alleviate the pain. Look, the problem became that the opioid people were putting the stuff out there and basically telling the people to sell it, their own people to sell it. It got out of hand. We have opioid addiction all over the country, all over the world. And, you know, there's a balance here. This lawsuit, I suspect, won't end up causing anything to happen except a consciousness, which is that there is a place for these drugs, but it has to be severely, severely monitored. And that's what didn't happen the last time. And that's why we're in the position we're in.
from prescription drugs to vaccinations, Alan. This week marked the start of school. It also was officially announced that the measles epidemic in Queens, especially among the Orthodox Jewish population, is over. Now, New York passed a law that says there will be no religious exemptions from vaccinations. And as school starts this week, we have the issue of some students not being able to go because they're not vaccinated.
Well, look, I know where I stand on this one, but that's my own personal feeling, and that is that when children are at risk, and they were, and the whole population, because there was what looked like a measles epidemic beginning, I think vaccination is important. I think the state has a right to do it. Obviously, people can hide behind religion for anything they want to do. They don't want to serve gay people. They say it's my religion that does that. You know, it's all very hypocritical in my mind. And that's this country. That's why we have a First Amendment. That's why, we protect freedom of religion. Nevertheless, there are points at which a line has to be drawn. I believe it was correct to draw this line in New York State.
The intersection of national and state politics, Alan. The President of the United States is directed essential funding for military construction projects to head to fund the border wall, and that's affecting most states in the nation, including New York, with Senators Schumer and Gillibrand condemning the administration for projects at West Point that will suffer.
This goes on all over the country, obviously. If Groton, Connecticut is building submarines, I'm not saying they're going to stop building it, but obviously these are terribly important projects. The Congress has passed them, has funded them, and yet along comes a guy and he says, we're going to take these away. I'm making this by administrative fiat, and we're not going to have these protections that the Congress voted for. We're just going to do what we think is, the president says, we're just going to do what I say. There is a question as to whether when money has been appropriated, it should be used for the purpose it was appropriated for. Now, there's a second part to this, and that's not quite as attractive, and that is that there are legislators who insist that these projects go forward in order to bring economic support for their region. That's good, but it's not the same thing. What happens in those cases is economic development is more important than the purposes, I suspect, for which these militaristic projects were developed. I got to tell you, we all know about the military-industrial congressional complex. We know that. Eisenhower warned us about it. It is so. Huge amounts of money are spent in this country that could be going for other purposes. But it's almost too familiar a refrain to be using right now because it is really not where this country should be.
Looming census, Alan, the issue of getting every person counted. We recently had the battle over putting the U.S. citizenship question on the census, but our Dave Lucas did a story about how many officials, including in the capital region of New York, are really worried about making sure these people are counted.
Let me tell you, if we don't count our people, other states will. They'll win, we'll lose. And because it's going to have direct relationship to how many congressmen each state has, what resources are given to that state, if New Yorkers can't manage to have an accurate count, there's going to be hell to pay. Now, let's face it, we know that there will be folks who don't want to be counted for a lot of different reasons. The whole idea of a census is you count everybody, whether or not they are here officially in the United States. But can you imagine if you were somebody who was hiding from the feds and from ICE, that you would volunteer to be interviewed because it's good for New York State? I doubt it very much.
Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Chartok. You You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. From the decriminalization of marijuana to the marijuana industry itself, which is in a time of transition in New York State, medical marijuana is legal, recreational marijuana is not. In Albany County, Curaleaf, New York, marked its first anniversary recently at its medical marijuana cultivation and processing center at the Queeman's Industrial Park in Ravenna. The Legislative Gazette's Jesse King was there for an inside look.
We're going to go into the mom room, okay? In the mom rooms, we grow these plants as big as we can, and we take cuttings off of them. So we're not actually flowering them. We're growing them just into big plants, and we're taking those cuttings, and those are called clones. So we get anywhere from 25 to 35 clones off each mom, and the next room that we'll go in within that airlock is the clone room, and that's, consider that like the nursery.
You have to go through several decontamination checkpoints just to get into the bright airlocked mom and clone rooms at Curaleaf's 72,000-square-foot warehouse. General Manager of New York Operations Nate McDonald is decked out in scrubs, hairnets, and Crocs as he nudges lanes of moms to make room for their equally sanitized visitors. Over 20 strains of cannabis fill the room, and while McDonald won't list them by name, that's part of the Curaleaf recipe, he says it's a wide range.
Some high THC, some balanced, which a mixture of THC and CBD, and some that are high CBD. Depending on what our production cycle is and what type of medication that we're making for the patients will depend how many of those plants we're going to grow.
From clone to harvest, McDonald says, takes about 12 weeks. Just one of the warehouse's flower rooms, showered in high-pressure sodium lighting to simulate the sun, contains thousands of plants. Head grower Elizabeth Kaiser says the ultimate prize is the cola, a clump of buds at the top.
The cola, like, is where the most dense population of trichomes are. So the trichomes are the glands where THC is produced.
Once colas are harvested, they're dried and ground up. McDonald likens the consistency to oregano. From there, it's about processing, pressing liquid CO2 through the oregano to extract its oils, purifying it, reinserting its natural terpenes or flavors, and distilling the final oils to match the potency required of each Curaleaf product.
What you guys will see is a lot of automation in this room. So I would say, you know, automation Alex, automation Marcia, automation Seth.
McDonald's being facetious, because as technical as the rest of the Curaleaf operation is, automation hasn't yet taken hold in the medical marijuana industry. Each of the company's products is filled, packaged, and stickered by hand. Curaleaf currently offers vaporizer cartridges, tinctures, and mint-flavored microtablets to patients dealing with cancer, AIDS, PTSD, and more. Companies like Curaleaf are walking a fine line for the moment. New York lawmakers left the Capitol in June without legalizing recreational marijuana, even as neighboring states have embraced it. So McDonald is careful to call Curaleaf's upcoming gummy-looking Curachews oral medication, as New York State does not allow the production of edibles found at pot shops as close as Berkshire County. Dr. Lynn Porodnik says customers in New York have been heading to Massachusetts, where recreational marijuana is legal, for wider product variety.
Particularly cancer patients, old women who are not so comfortable with the idea of using marijuana. If it comes in a cookie, it seems a lot less stigmatized. So many families have found that if they just go to the border, bring back some nice candy cookies, grandma and grandpa are much happier.
Part of the massive production at Curaleaf New York is in preparation for Curachews and the company's eventual ground flower vape pods. McDonald says Curaleaf is a medical company and didn't comment on whether the company could ever transition to recreational marijuana in the event of full legalization. But Curaleaf pharmacist Stacia Woodcock says any expansion would create better access for its patients.
We'll see patients on a pain medication and then something to help them sleep and then something for anxiety and then something to keep them awake because their pain medicine makes them tired. And to replace all of that with one thing that's been proven over 5,000 years, you can't overdose. It's not fatal. It's safe for patients. It provides relief in a way that very few pharmaceuticals do, has been really rewarding.
Curaleaf New York says the current patient-to-dispensary ratio in the state is 1 to every 500,000 people. Curaleaf New York serves nearly 20,000 customers between its four dispensaries in Plattsburgh, Newburgh, Carle Place on Long Island, and Forest Hills in Queens. Reporting from Ravenna, I'm Jesse King.
New York, U.S. Senator Charles Schumer was in northern New York recently to illustrate how a new USDA plan could hurt honeybee colonies. The Legislative Gazette's Pat Bradley was there.
Fourth-generation beekeeper Richard Crawford, the president of the Champlain Valley Beekeepers Association, has 86 hives with about 5 million bees, producing about 2 tons of honey annually. Crawford donned a protective mask as his brother Doug described what he was doing.
What he's doing is lighting the smoker. It blocks the scent. He pulls it up real slow. No fast moves, no agitation.
And the queen is right there.
And she looks different. She's longer. And she's running around frantic right there because it's been disturbed. Okay. But you can see how calm they are. They're not stinging. They're worried about their hive. They're worried about the honey that's there. They're worried about all of that, not him.
Continuing an effort that brought him to Schenectady in July, Democratic Senator Charles Schumer visited Crawford's bee colonies in Morrisonville to express concern about a U.S. Department of Agriculture plan to stop collecting data on honeybees. He says the insects are crucial for pollinating crops, but the hives are dying off.
In New York State, $1.2 billion worth of crops depend on our bees. And we also, of course, have an industry of honey. The active number of honeybee colonies in the United States plummeted from 6 million to 2.5 million in 2017. No one quite knows why so many bee colonies are dying off. We do know without them, our agriculture industry would come to a standstill. In 2018, New York State lost 14,700 bee colonies. So, we have a real problem.
New York Farm Bureau field advisor Kim Trombley says honeybees provide 50% of the pollination across New York, yet their population continues to decline.
These losses not only impact our honey producers, but also our farms that rely on pollination from honeybees. The continuation of the honeybee colony survey reinforces the importance of agriculture to the overall economy. It is imperative that honeybee colonies are accurately monitored to ensure the sustainability and longevity of New York agriculture and the overall food system.
Schumer says it's unknown why the USDA decided to cut the $10 to $12 million in funding for data collection, which the Democrat calls crucial.
The survey will tell us two things: where the bees are dying out, but more importantly, it's going to give us the information as to why, the great mystery as to why the bee colonies are dying. And we need the scientific data. That tells us everything.
The Honeybee Colonies Report has been conducted annually by the National Agricultural Statistics Service, tracking active, new, and lost colonies.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Pat Bradley.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. New York State has a new strategy to bring services to child victims of physical and sexual abuse. Specialized Winnebagos are being deployed to rural and underserved areas. More now from the Legislative Gazette's Lucas Willard.
Parked outside the Child Advocacy Center in Fulton County in Johnstown on Wednesday was a white recreational vehicle. While it appears like an ordinary camper, the vehicle is one of 7 mobile child advocacy centers. The mobile units are a joint project between the State Office of Children and Family Services and Office of Victim Services. Office of Children and Family Services Commissioner Sheila Poole commented on the exterior appearance of the RV.
I think the care that's been taken in the actual physical design of the mobile unit, it doesn't have any right signage or affix. You know, it looks like someone's right sort of vacation, right recreational vehicle, or a bookmobile, which also I think, you know, is symbolic of our desire to protect confidentiality of children who will be interviewed, as well as families who come here to take part in service delivery.
The interior has been designed from the ground up to accommodate children and families. Outfitted with toys, pictures, and snacks, the unit is designed to make the investigation process less traumatic for children who are the victims of physical or sexual abuse. Janine Dykeman, executive director of the Mental Health Association in Fulton and Montgomery counties, pointed out the amenities within the mobile CAC.
Actually, that's the interview section right here. So this is where children would be, where interviewing would be going on. This room that you're in right now, this is the observation room. So we would have law enforcement or Department of Social Services sitting here.
All units are also equipped with recording and observation equipment, a waiting area, and a bathroom. The Mental Health Association received $250,000 from the state for the purchase of the unit and will receive $50,000 annually over a 3-year period to cover operation and maintenance expenses. Dykeman says the unit will serve a region where inadequate public transportation is a big issue.
Really for everything, for work, for people that are going to college, for people who might need services, getting to Department of Social Services, any of those pieces, transportation is a big challenge in our communities.
The RV parked in Johnstown on Wednesday will be able to serve Fulton, Montgomery, as well as Hamilton counties. Funding for the mobile units is also supporting programs for the Clinton County District Attorney's Office to serve Essex and Franklin counties, as well as the St. Regis Reservation, Delaware County Department of Social Services, Parent Education Program in Allegheny and Cattaraugus counties, Steuben County Department of Social Services, and the Victim Assistance Program of Jefferson County, with one unit for St. Lawrence County and the other for Lewis County. Elizabeth Cronin, director of the Office of Victim Services, says the mobile units are in addition to a strategy to establish more child advocacy centers across the state, with 58 centers statewide covering every county.
So that there is a brick and mortar safe space for families who are able to get to the interview, but now they'll have a place to go where people are trained in forensic interviewing, that the children won't have to go through multiple interviews. So it's kind of a win-win all the way around, whether you have transportation or you don't.
New York's child advocacy centers service approximately 24,000 children each year.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Lucas Willard.
A controversial natural gas pipeline plan for New York is back on the table after the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission said the project can go forward. The Legislative Gazette's Dave Lucas explains.
FERC gave new life to the proposed Constitution Pipeline this week. It would carry hydrofracked natural gas from Pennsylvania's shale gas fields through New York's southern tier to Schoharie County. FERC approved the 124-mile pipeline project in 2014, contingent on a New York State permit required under the Federal Clean Water Act. Some local officials and labor groups argued the pipeline was essential, as natural gas consumption was on the rise. Construction was to have begun in late spring of 2015 and was expected to be completed by the summer of 2016. Environmental groups argued the pipeline would threaten public health and open the door to toxic emissions and water pollution, not to mention the possibility of explosions. They said the project would impact 277 waterways, 1,000 acres of forest and farmland, and 700,000 trees. By November of 2015, the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation had not acted on essential water quality permits, and in April 2016, opted not to grant any. Wednesday's FERC decision stated DEC waived its right to block the water permits because it waited too long to take action. Former EPA Region 2 Administrator Judith Enck points out that all the reasons why the DEC rejected the permit and all of the community concerns are still there, regardless of what she characterizes as FERC's unusual position on this.
Which I think also contradicts an important court decision that came out on this pipeline.
Speaking during a 2016 protest at the Capitol in Albany, pipeline opponent and Delaware County resident Colleen McKinney contended no one in Pennsylvania, New York, or New England would benefit from the line because the gas it would carry would be going to Canada via the Iroquois pipeline.
This gas is not for us. These companies want to export it because natural gas prices in the rest of the world are much higher than they are here. Profit is their only concern.
Inc. is sending out a renewed alarm.
We are heading into a holiday weekend where Florida is bracing for a very strong hurricane. The Amazon rainforest is still on fire. And yet, the Trump administration continues to promote the development of fossil fuels. Putting up pipelines and compressor stations are giant, multi-million, sometimes multi-billion dollar investments by the fossil fuel industry, that if the investment is made, they are going to expect it to be operational for 40, 50, 60 years.
Officials with Constitution Pipeline and DEC did not immediately respond to requests for comment. A FERC official directed WAMC to a document on the agency's website. You can view it at WAMC.org.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Dave Lucas.
And that about does it for this week's show. We had help from the New York State Public Radio Network. For copies, call 1-800-323-9262. That's 1-800-323-9262. Ask for program number 1936. Or just listen or podcast on the web at WAMC.org. And join us again next week at this same time for more news on New York State government, politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Gustina.